Monday morning, the 13th of July. It is early, and the light outside is still that thin gray that hasn't decided what kind of day it wants to be. I have been up a while with the weekend's reading, and I want to tell you something I noticed only after I had all four of these pieces side by side. Pour yourself a cup, let me show you what I mean. First up, a small consultancy did something almost nobody bothers to do. They put a logging proxy at the boundary between a coding agent and the model behind it, and they wrote down exactly what gets sent. Two harnesses, same model underneath, fresh configuration, empty workspace, no plugins, no memory files. Just a stopwatch and a ledger. Here is what the ledger says. Before Claude Code has looked at a single character of your prompt, it has already sent roughly 33,000 tokens. A system prompt of about 27,000 characters across three blocks. 27 tool definitions running to nearly 100,000 characters of schema. Another 8,000 characters of scaffolding reminders. OpenCode, doing the same job, sends about 7,000. The gap is 4.7 to 1, and about 3/4 of it is tool schemas. 24,000 tokens of them on one side, under 5,000 on the other. Now the obvious conclusion from that number is that one harness is nearly 5 times more expensive than the other, and the reason I want to walk you through this carefully is that the obvious conclusion is wrong. On the multi-step task, write some code, run it, watch it fail, fix it, Claude Code made 3 requests to the model and burned about 121,000 tokens. OpenCode made 9 requests and spent about 132,000. Claude Code batches its tool calls in parallel and pays its enormous baseline 3 times. OpenCode does 1 tool call per turn and pays its small baseline 9 times. Und Henny did the 2 totals converge, and both harnesses finished every task correctly. Where the gap does not close is caching. OpenCode sends a byte identical prefix on every single request, so on a repeat run, it wrote 0 cache tokens. Claude Code sends 3 distinct classes of request per session, each needing its own cache entry, and it was caught rewriting its entire 43,000 token prefix in the middle of a task. On the same job, 53,800 cache write tokens against 1,003. That is a 54-to-1 ratio at the extreme. And the configuration multipliers dwarf the harness gap anyway. A 72 kilobyte instructions file adds 20,000 tokens to every request. Each small model context protocol server costs you 1,000 to 1,400. Subagents are the big one. A 2-subagent fanout consumed 513,000 tokens for work that took 121,000 done in line. 4.2 times for the privilege of delegating. The sample is small. 3 runs here, 1 run there, 1 machine. And the authors are careful to say they are not claiming the premium fails to buy quality on harder problems. They simply did not measure that. What they did establish is that on tasks where both harnesses succeed, an enormous share of the difference in your bill is scaffolding, not intelligence. Moving on to our second story, which is also an exercise in counting, though the units are dollars. An analysis from the research firm IO Fund, published in June and pushed back onto the front page over the weekend, lays out the balance sheets behind the companies renting graphics processing units to the labs. The commitments first. Microsoft holds around $60 billion in commitments to these so-called neoclouds. Meta has committed $35.2 billion to CoreWeave and up to $27 billion to Nebius. Add the deals tied to OpenAI and Anthropic, and the total potential commitments pass $145 billion. Now hold that number against what these companies actually earn. CoreWeave's estimated revenue for this year is $12.6 billion. Nebius is expected to do 3.4. CoreWeave's first quarter tells the story in miniature. Revenue of $2.08 billion, up 112% year-over-year. Genuinely spectacular growth. But operating cash flow of just under $3 billion against capital expenditure of $7.7 billion, which leaves free cash flow at negative $4.7 billion. Cash on hand fell 28%. Debt climbed to nearly $25 billion. Against full-year spending guidance, the analyst computes a funding gap of $17.3 $1 billion. Across five post-listing quarters, the company has raised $3.5 billion in equity and more than five times that, nearly $19 billion in debt. Interest payments alone now eat $1 in every $4 of revenue, and the debt is collateralized by the chips. CoreWeave has closed six graphics processor-backed term loans. One of them, an $8.5 billion facility, is the first of its kind to earn an investment-grade credit rating, earned not on the borrower's own balance sheet, which is weak, but on a long-term contract with a creditworthy customer, plus the hardware itself, as collateral. Meanwhile, the chip vendor has put $2 billion into each of these companies and is contractually obliged to buy CoreWeave's unsold residual capacity through April of 2032. Investor, supplier, and buyer of last resort, all at once. The author is fair about the counter-arguments. Speed is a genuine moat. These companies deploy in weeks where others take months. Their published utilization figures sit above the industry band, and she concedes, the hyperscalers are perfectly capable of doing their own optimization. The line that stays with me is her own summary. Revenue lags capital expenditure 2-to-1, and you can see why the hyperscalers like the arrangement. Microsoft is guiding to $190 billion in capital spending, against roughly $200 billion in operating cash flow, 95% of everything it generates. Push the commitment out to a partner on a contract running to 2032, and it stops being capital expenditure at all. Third up, and the counting here, is of bugs. Terence Tao spent the last few days migrating his old web material into something maintainable, and along the way, he asked a coding agent to port the applets he first wrote in 1999, teaching visualizations for complex analysis and linear algebra, a Besicovitch set demo, a honeycomb applet he wrote with Alan Knutson that he describes as particularly tricky to code by hand. The language they were written in stopped being supported, and they had all been broken for years. The agent ported the lot in a matter of hours. And here is the accounting, which is the reason this is the third story and not a footnote. Across roughly two dozen ported applets, he could find exactly one bug the agent had introduced, a drag event misbehaving when the cursor leaves the box. In the same pass, the agent found two bugs in his original code that he had never known about. His verdict, a net wash as far as code quality is concerned. He then went further and built two things he had abandoned decades ago as too complex. One is a diagram editor for special relativity, which he describes as Inkscape, but in Minkowski space, an idea he started in 1999 and gave up on when the complexity got away from him. A couple of hours of what he calls vibe coding, and it finally matched the vision he had. The other is a visualizer for the Gilbreth conjecture, written the same day as his paper on it, and he says he may start shipping interactive visualizations alongside future papers as a matter of course. What I appreciate is how carefully he draws the boundary. He says more than once that these applets are visual aids rather than load-bearing components of a mathematical argument, so the downside risk of a latent bug is low. The acceptability of the method is a function of the stakes, not of the tooling. He also says plainly that his own programming experience and his domain knowledge were essential, both to get useful code out of the agent and to diagnose what came back. The high-level design decision stayed with him. For the relativity editor, separating the data model, which stores everything against a fixed, hidden laboratory rest frame, from the interface, which renders only in the two frames the user can see. That was something he had to specify himself, or the agent could not have captured the spirit of the principle of relativity at all. It is the low-level syntax that has been automated away, not the judgment. And one small thing worth saying, given how the story is being retold, he never names a model, a vendor, or a product anywhere in the post. And for our fourth and final story today, what is being counted is time. Nathan Lambert, writing at Interconnects, argues that the open weights ecosystem is facing the first serious policy threat with a credible enforcement path behind it, and he puts a clock on it. His prediction is that within roughly 6 months, action will ban or indefinitely delay the release of any open weights model meaningfully above the capability band occupied by GPT 5.5, Claude Opus 4.8, and GLM 5.2. He is careful to label this a forecast rather than reporting. He points to discussion of a possible executive order, says explicitly that there is no official information, and notes that a first version would likely touch only models of Chinese origin and government uses. His concern is what follows. Once a capability threshold triggers a right of review, that review will move far more slowly for open models than for closed ones, partly because closed models are easier to secure and partly because their owners have more effective representation. He separates two arguments that he says are being run together. The first is distillation, the concern that a competitor trains on your model's outputs. The second is frontier capability itself. On the first, he is blunt, and on the second, he is not. He calls the capability question genuinely hard and genuinely new. His worry is contagion, that the enforcement machinery built for the first problem gets picked up and applied to the second because it already exists. He also makes a containment point that is straightforwardly logical. If a model is not restricted everywhere, a determined actor can still obtain and run it, which removes the safety benefit while leaving the economic cost on the inference providers, the fine-tuning shops, the products built on open weights, fully in place. His proposed off-ramp is concrete. A United States company releasing a comparably capable open model would change the frame entirely. He nominates the two large platform companies with a commoditize your compliments reason to do it, and suggests one well-funded startup may need to ship whatever it has simply to preserve the business it has described. Worth noting that a European group answered part of that call this same weekend, releasing a 30 billion parameter sovereign model for German and English, trained on 27 trillion tokens on infrastructure inside Germany, with the weights, intermediate checkpoints, and full per-source data accounting all published. So, four pieces, and it took me a while to see what they had in common. Every one of them is somebody sitting down and actually counting a thing the field usually just asserts. Tokens in the first, dollars in the second, bugs in the third, and months in the fourth. Nobody in this morning's reading discovered a new capability. What they did was measure the cost of one, and in three of the four cases, the number turned out to be somewhere nobody was looking, in the scaffolding, not the model, on the balance sheet, not the benchmark, in the design decision, not the syntax. There are 45 items in the full digest, including a result showing that within-class variance in language model representations is not incomplete neural collapse, but an information floor, which I found rather beautiful. Go and have a look if that is your sort of thing. That is Monday. I will be back tomorrow. Until then, keep reading papers.